Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
The best analogy I can come up with is sort of Hemingway's writing style. Write a sentence and then find out whatever words you can take out of that sentence that aren't necessary to get it down to its very essence and as short as possible. And I think that is the key to commercial fly tying in general and mass producing patterns, is having everything that needs to be there and nothing that doesn't need to be there.
That was Nick Pianessa describing how to make a parachute dry more consistent. Dry fly tips and how to fish, Nick's top five today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thank you for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. Please smash that subscribe button if you can, or it might be a follow button. Check it out on your app of choice. Just click down in that, if you're new to the show, and click subscribe. And double bonus today, if you share this episode, you will want to give me a shout out as well, because this is going to be an awesome episode, and I'd love to hear if you enjoyed it. Before we get started, let's hear from our sponsors. Tressel designs, engineers, and manufactures industry-leading outdoor products and premium apparel. From their patented game-changing telescopic fly rod carrier and their specialized waterproof cases and fly boxes to their magnetic nipper system that are revolutionizing how people snip their line. Please head over to wetflyswing.com/tressel to get started today. That's wetflyswing.com/tressel. TRXSTLE to support this podcast and an amazing product and brand today. We are also presented today by Deddy Flies. Deddy Flies, established in 1928, is the oldest family-run fly shop in the world in their 94th year now. Pretty amazing to have Deddy on. Their mission has always been to connect and create great products for the fly fishing community. We've got more to come from Deddy as well, so just want to jump into it and give a big virtual high five to Deddy. If you get a chance, please give Deddy a high five as well. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/Deddy, and let's wrap this intro up and get into it. Nick Pianessa takes us on a journey today of becoming a full-time production fly tire, and he's out in the northeast part of the country. We hear about a little bit out around the New York area, what it was like for him and what it's like now and what he focuses on, but he's covering things all around the country. Nick walks us through some of the most effective and requested dry fly patterns, how to make a steelhead shank, and his life tying and fishing steelhead and trout flies for a living. So, without further ado, here is Nick Pianessa. How's it going, Nick?
It's going great, Dave. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for taking some time this morning to dig into this.
You're welcome.
You're a commercial fly tire. You got a lot of flies on your Instagram feed, and you're up in the Northeast. So we're going to dig into a few topics, maybe focus a little bit on trout today, trout flies and tying and things like that. But before we jump into that, take us back to, I always like to go back to how you first got into fly fishing. So take us there.
Well, probably the first times I fly fished was on a pond. One of my older brothers owned a little cabin on a pond, and I think probably to get us out of his hair more than anything, sent us out to the dock with a fly rod and some wet flies. And we, you know, backcasted and bent hooks on the boats behind us and everything else, and managed to drag a few bluegills and doing it. And the idea was kind of fascinating right off, of the ability to create this thing that I could catch fish with.
Yeah.
That really kind of sparked an interest pretty much immediately. from there, it was, you know, kind of a circuitous path that I think a lot of people take. I did a lot of fishing as a kid locally, where you have, you know, some streams right around here that were easy enough to bike to or walk to. And my friends were kind of into it too. At this point, you know, mostly spin fishing, pike and smallmouth bass and whatever, you know, whatever we could find around here in the creeks and ponds. The whole time kind of fiddling with fly fishing a bit. I remember having a couple of old, one I still even is sitting right here is an old Eagle Claw fly rod, one of the first ones I ever actually bought. And, you know, just started using that a little bit sometimes, you know, sometimes it still had a live crayfish on it. You know, it was kind of sorting things out and figuring it out. And a little later, as I was in high school, I took a fly tying class once. I took one fly tying class from a kind of a local legend here, Mr. Jim Keach, at the local store. And from there, it was just, you know, just fly tying just completely took off. And I don't think I've fished with a spinning rod ever since. So,
and what was that? How old were you when you took that class with Jim Keach?
You know, it's probably, I was just out of high school. I was probably like 18 or 19.
Okay. Yeah. Just out of high school.
So that would have been probably, 88, probably 89, somewhere in there.
Yeah. There you go. And then when did it become, so now you're kind of like commercial tying, right? Is that kind of the full what you're spending most of your time doing these days?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I do some guiding. Our guiding's a little limited here in the Great Lakes, you know, kind of a fall, spring season. So mostly, you know, fly tying with supplementing a little guiding in there.
A little guiding. Okay. And on the commercial tying, so how did you go from that first with Jim Keach up to fully like, the, you know, 100% with the tying?
Let's see. Well, it probably just, I'm trying to think of the, I tried to think of this before and I can't really come up with a definitive answer. It just seems to sort of happen. I think probably the first order I ever did was for, my friend Rick's, shop at the time was Oak Orchard Fly Shop. They were out in, Albion, on the Oak Orchard River where they kind of first started. And, his partner, Bob Morrissey, I think, is probably one of the guys that gave me the first order, I'll bet. And it was for a pattern. There's a fly here in the Northeast that commonly referred to as a gray fox. It's one of the kind of March Brown family or like Cahill family of insects. And because it's kind of a niche hatch, there weren't a lot of commercial patterns available for it and none that Bob liked. Bob was the kind of guy that he was a very good fly tyer, but he hated tying flies. He hated, the actual act of, producing flies, you know, tying them for himself to fish was great, but, sitting down and tying a bunch for the shop was just not going to happen. So he talked me into it and, I kind of started there and I realized I could do it, you know, and, could put up with the kind of inherent boredom of it. It's probably the biggest thing you got to get around. You know, from there, I just, you know, just kind of snowballed and kind of kept progressing. At the time I was working in printing. So I had a, you know, full-time job in the printing industry and I was, you know, actively working there and then just, you know, started taking on more and more fly tying orders.
Gotcha. How do you, when you're doing it now, how do you get past the boredom?
Mostly books on tape. Mm-hmm. Little bit of radio here and there, you know, I listen to the, you know, if there's a something interesting on. Apparently I need to explore podcasts a little bit more.
Yeah.
That I guess wouldn't be a bad idea. But yeah, stuff like that I find you know, it's recently the last year or so I've been on a little bit of a Stephen King kick. It's interesting enough reading, but not engrossing enough to kind of distract you. That's been kind of recently, I guess the books I've been gravitating to are stuff like that. A lot of the classics too. I was able to plow through most of the classics that, you know, you always have this list of classic books you wanted to read and never have time to. So it was a very fortunate to be able to kind of plow through that too. So
There you go. So basically, yeah, and I think the books on tape are good. And if you like books on tape, you definitely will like podcasts, because there's always, it's just like Stephen King. There's probably five, or who knows, maybe there's 100 podcasts on Stephen King out there that are just like, you know, Stephen King, whatever, a book club. You know, I mean, there's a podcast for everything. That's where it's grown.
Yeah, after talking to you recently, I did look around a little bit, and I was honestly astounded at this world that I know very little about.
Yeah, it's good. That's good. Well, that's the cool thing about podcasting, is that, just for perspective, you know, there's hundreds of millions of blogs out there and YouTube channels, but podcasting is still relatively small compared to those, you know, so there's still a ton of room for growth. Mm. And that's the cool thing, is that it's just, we're kind of, things are expanding kind of right now, blowing up, but I think it's going to keep growing, and we're going to keep seeing new cool shows coming in, which is great.
It is.
So tell me a little bit about, you know, the commercial tying. So how many, like, just give us a perspective, how many flies are you tying per day, per week? How's that look?
Well, it's a typical self-employment situation. So, generally deadline fear, you know, turns most of the wheels here. I work at it pretty much every day. I work at it a lot of times, you know, watching TV. We watched a bunch of football yesterday, go Bills. Mm-hmm. And, you know, while doing that, I was, you know, prepping Shanks, for example. Yesterday was the project, you know, cutting trailer, braid for Shanks. And so, like anybody that runs a small business, I'm sure people are extremely familiar with this. It never really seems to end. You're kind of constantly, you know, working, whether you're, you know, conscious of it or not, or whether you're sitting at your desk working, or, you know, walking around the house working, yep. Or for that matter, watching football working. So there's that. I'd say, you know, a productive day, I try to, if it's steelhead flies, I'll try to get a couple dozen steelhead flies done a day. If it's trout flies, it really depends on whether I have a large order of the exact same thing, or if I'm doing, you know, nine of these and six of these and, kind of hopping around. Mm-hmm. I do both. So it really varies a lot. Yeah. When I was tying commercially for shops more, I would shoot for somewhere around 100 flies a day.
Okay.
Trout flies. And it's a, you know, it's unbearable in a sense, and in another sense, it's kind of par for the course, or what you should be able to do.
Yeah.
Especially if you, you know, care to kind of, you know, put a roof over your head and that type of stuff too. And you know, it really depends. As for me, it's most of my income. For a lot of people, it's a hobby, or it's a, you know, it's a, you know, kind of side gig or something. So maybe, efficiency isn't necessarily key. But from a commercial standpoint, the orders where you've got, you know, whatever, 1,000 of the exact same thing to tie are the most boring, but the best, money producers. So, there's really, it's a hard thing to answer as far as kind of production per day. Really just trying to kind of, I'd say putting in, you know, a solid 6 hours a day, almost every day.
6 hours a day. Yeah. I remember I tied commercially quite a while ago, and I remember that was about the same. I always felt like eight to 10 dozen a day was pretty good. It was a really good day. Know what I mean? And you're tying all sorts of things. So are you tying kind of a little bit of everything? Talk about that. Like on the trout flies, who are you putting these orders now? If it's just trout flies, and are you tying a mix of dry flies and like nymphs and everything?
Let's see. I'd say I probably tie the most dry flies. Yeah, unquestionably the most dry flies. I think it's probably a little bit of a mix of my customer base, a little bit of a mix of what I offer as well, and then sort of what I've kind of specialized in. And over the years, I've developed a bit of a customer base of people who realize that they, it's a funny situation in fly fishing. It's one thing that's always puzzled me is there's guys that are extremely into fly fishing that don't tie.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you find these guys that they're thinking about it exactly the same way I am. In, you know, I see this bug emerging, I see what it's doing, I see how the fish are reacting to it. And I want something that looks like that and fits that, you know, that imagination they have of what is actually happening there. But yet they're not really doing it themselves. So I've kind of developed this bit of a following over the years that I can sort of do that for people that don't tie, but have that very inquisitive, very you know, sharp or mind for sharp details on what's going on out there. So a lot of my patterns now have kind of developed, you know, started off maybe as one thing that have kind of developed between customer preference and, you know, really kind of what we're seeing and what the fish are doing. And also, too, the fact that the little buggers learn about as fast as we can change stuff. So, you know, constantly evolving fly patterns, too, seems to be a real niche these days, too.
Oh, yeah. And how do you do this? So if you have somebody coming in, describe that process. Somebody's coming in and they're saying, hey, I have this thing in my mind. How do you tease out what that fly looks like exactly?
Okay, yeah, we usually, typically, I'm trying to think, and I just had this happen the other day, so I'm thinking we started off with a photo that the customer actually found online somewheres, and it was an idea that was actually kind of interesting, I thought, and something I hadn't really seen before, and then it was a matter of changing the colors to meet what we wanted. I think we added a trailing shuck to the pattern, and this was this pattern was a little soft tackle that would be fish dry. And this is mainly for the Delaware River in New York here, which has, in my opinion, the West Branch of the Delaware has some of the pickiest trout in the country. I've never fished anywhere but America, but as far as my findings in America go, there are very few harder to catch trout than these guys. Again, kind of an ever-evolving fly pattern. And again, this customer, you know, saw something that caught his eye and sparked an interest. And I haven't even tied any yet. We'll see what comes out. I'd say, you know, we probably have a, I'd say 75 to maybe even as high as 90% success rate. You know, a few clunkers in there for sure.
That's awesome. How do you get when you're tying that fly? You got this new fly. How many does it take you to tie before you have that thing completely dialed in? So each one is exact.
Yeah, no, that's a great question because it really, it is a process, no doubt. And most of these patterns, I would say, this one's relatively simple. It doesn't have a lot of parts. I'd say probably half a dozen or so before I've got, you know, kind of a good solid base down. I wouldn't say I really understand tying the pattern until you got through the first 100. And I know this from my production numbers go up considerably. Once I get past 100 flies, it seems like I really, you know, you know what you're picking up before you're even picking it up, for the next step. Before that, a lot of times you're like, what am I doing? Oh yeah, I need this, you know, oh, that's right, I'm doing this. And then eventually it falls into where you're just kind of automatically adding the next part without even really having to think about it. So, you know, based on that, I'd say, yeah, somewhere in 100 flies or so, you really get it down. The beauty of it is that I get to fish a lot of this stuff myself and test them and, you know, kind of fiddle with them from there. If it's not something I originally fiddled with first before sort of turning loose on the public, if this is sort of an on-the-spot development, it's more of a, you know, try some of these out, you know, well, this one didn't float right, or this lays on its side, or it doesn't, you know, a lot of fiddling with stuff. And then, you know, probably a good half a dozen. Once we decide on the pattern, probably a good half dozen to kind of get it, you know, the hackle the right length, the shuck the right length, the, you know, whatever, all that. And that's always, I think, one of the hardest things for people to kind of put together in fly tying, based on the number of classes I've done with beginners. Everything is out of proportion to begin with. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, really gels as you do more and more flies.
Yeah, proportions are definitely a tough one for some people, especially getting started. So that's pretty cool. So these flies, like on your website, I think people can come and buy flies on your website, the flies that they could buy like right now. How many of them are flies that are just your standard versus flies that were developed by working with another customer?
I'd say pretty much every pattern on my stuff. There are a couple. I think there's a few flies that are kind of standards, but otherwise pretty much everything on there has been kind of developed through trial and error. Some of them have changed drastically over the years. And some of them are, you know, almost the same as they were kind of, conceived. It's weird how that works, but yeah, most of the stuff that's on my site anyways has kind of been, self-developed.
That's cool.
you know, well, as much as, yeah, and as much as you can see that in fly tying these days. I mean, let's face it, it's all been lashed on a hook at some point. So,
yeah, no, it's true. Well, I was thinking, we had Tim Flagler on recently, and we were talking of a similar deal, and he was talking about that, you know, on one of his things, how, you know, just changing an old fly, giving it a new hook with a new design or something can, you know, can change it up a little bit, sure. Right? Just that. And he also made a good, he had a good tip. It was the, like you're talking about, how do you get good? He said he had an old guy when he first started, you'd probably know him. I can't remember his name, but he said this guy gave him the great tip starting out. He said, tie 15 flies and then go through each of the 15 and take your three worst flies and give them away. And then he says that helps him understand, you know what I mean? You get really picky about it. Anyways, he learned that one early on. So I'll put a link in the show notes to that episode. But it seems like you're, like you said, nine dozen flies, you're feeling pretty good about. Everything's looking the same.
Yeah, oh, definitely. It usually happens before that, but I'd say, you know, in that range, you're really pretty dialed in.
Yeah. Who is the customer base? So it sounds like you got people all over the place, but on the flies on your website, where would you say those customers were coming from?
Well, Northeast for sure. I'm thinking of shipping addresses. Mm-hmm. Definitely a bit out west, both for trout and steelhead, but then the unique situation where some of my flies get bought here and then taken out to different places, which I always thought was one of the coolest things about commercial fly tying, is just all the great places my flies have gone. So that's always an interesting point. But I'd say, yeah, my customer base is largely Northeast, I would say.
Northeast. And whereas before, I want to dig into some of those kind of top flies that you tie there, you know, as far as maybe focus on dry flies. But as far as around the country or around the world, where are a couple places your flies have gone? Do you know?
Tons of places. I tie regularly for a couple people that run camps in Alaska. So a lot of stuff up there. A fair amount when I was tying a lot more commercially for shops. I tied for a few shops in the West, Blue Ribbon Flies in West Yellowstone. I tied a lot of flies for those guys. Originally, too, when I started, it's going back probably about 20 years or so, there's a very popular shop in the Northeast here called Hunter's Angling, which was in New Hampshire there. And I tied a lot of Atlantic salmon flies for them. And that was really kind of interesting to see. A lot of those flies went to even South America for the sea trout.
Oh, wow.
And then some Norway and European waters. And, of course, you know, Maritime Canada. So my flies have definitely traveled much more extensively than I have.
That's cool.
Yeah, it really is.
What are the – on your? Let's go to dry flies for a little bit as far as – your top flies, you know, something you get a lot of requests for. It sounds like you get a lot of different requests for little variations. But if you had to say, you know, kind of a top whatever 10 list of flies, do you have some regular flies or is it just like all over the board?
I'd say I'm trying to think of last year here. I'm just getting started on trout stuff for this year. So I'd say based on last year, probably the most popular fly of my own kind of creation is a fly called the Peacock Emerger, which is a bit of a half and half emerger, really originally designed on the sulfur hatch. We have a super fussy little spring creek here that the fish are just evil as far as fooling them, and unfortunately small on top of it. So it's a very humbling place, and I owe a large amount of my knowledge to that place. It's just a great testing ground, but it gets a tremendous sulfur hatch. Doesn't get a wide range of hatches, but it gets a tremendous sulfur hatch. So most of my sulfur patterns have been worked out over there. And this Peacock Emerger in particular, it imitates that stage on, and it's mostly on ephemerella species mayflies, but it does you know, happen with some other ones too, but where they hatch right into film. And essentially the little nymph swims up, you know, jams his head through the surface and uses that nymph exoskeleton as kind of a manhole to crawl out of onto the surface of the water. And that takes, it takes a little bit of time, you know, depending on the weather and temperature and humidity and all, for them to pull that off. Some bugs, you know, if the temperature's good and stuff, they bust right out and they're gone. Other ones struggle more. And one day in particular, I watched a fish that looked like he was eating nothing. And this is, you know, a huge sulfur hatch. I mean, there's bugs flopping around, you know, fish are jumping out of the water and trying to grab them out of the air. It's just, you know, going bonkers. And this fish, the biggest fish out there, is backing up and then eating stuff that I can't see. So what he was doing was waiting for this nymph to slam into the surface, get trapped for a second, and eat every one of them. The smaller fish are chasing the emergers and, you know, throwing themselves out of the water and, you know, snatching at duns that are getting away in front of them. And this guy probably ate every single bug that he moved for. And what I did was I watched him from the side I was on, the sort of fishing side. It's a creek where it's kind of open on one side and very brushy on the other side. So then I went up across the bridge, went over to the other side where I could see him closer. And a couple times just before he rose, I saw a little white kind of speck appear. And I guess that was the folded wing of the sulfur starting to poke out of the shuck. And then he would eat it. So based on that, I started thinking about this, you know, half and half emergence thing. And, you know, tied a fly, went back the next day, did not catch him, but got a couple looks from him. Went back, fiddled with it some more a few days later, went back and did end up catching him. So, and that's pretty much what he was doing. And he continued with the exact same thing. Actually, even after I caught him, he stuck with the exact same tactic.
There you go.
Cool. Yeah. And I've since seen fish in a lot of places do that. And it's that little transition. And again, you know, if you're fishing there's a stream that little spring creek goes into where, the fish are very picky too, but it's a bigger stream. There's a lot more fish, more of a freestone stream. And, you know, they'll take a Catskill sulfur, you know, a lot of times. And so it's odd that the water or the pressure or the whatever it is plays such a role in how these fish react. So if I have to put that much effort into catching every fish, it's kind of a long day. When necessary, I think we can, you know, use our, in most cases, much larger brain, to put one over on these guys. But it's not, I guess what I'm trying to say is that the effort isn't always necessary to do that.
Yeah.
But when we need to,
makes it fun.
Yeah. And it really, there's rivers where we need to, and everybody's got them. I hear these, spring creeks in California that are uber picky, for myself, I fished the Henry's Fork and, you know, a lot of the famous rivers around Yellowstone, which get a, you know, crazy amount of pressure despite, you know, the Western outlook and all that stuff. You know, they get as much pressure as a lot of these Eastern rivers. So fish are super picky. But, you know, thank God there's a lot of streams where it really doesn't matter. So.
A quick break from one of our sponsors, Togan's Fly Shop, providing great quality products at a super awesome price. Togan's has tons of fly tying materials, accessories, all sorts of stuff to cover you, and they've been going for quite some time now. If you have any questions, you can check out Togan's, wetflyswing.com/Togan's. They're offering now a fly tying box, which simplifies the process, especially if you're brand new to it. They'll send you out one shipment, and you can have your materials packed in one box. I know this is a struggle for some, especially getting started, or if you just want to mix it up. So the mystery fly tying box is a good place to dig into it. And, you know, they've got products that are going to arrive pretty quickly. I know when I last made my order, it was only a couple days to get my order from Togan's. So it's pretty cool. Togan's is actually up in Canada, which is awesome. And you would think that given where we're at today, that it might take a little bit longer, but they got their infrastructure set up pretty awesomely and very smoothly. So since 2005, Togan's has been rolling on this. You can head over, like I mentioned before, Togan's, wetflyswing.com/Togan's, T-O-G-E-N-S, to get started and support Justin and his pops right now today. Okay, let's get back to the show now. What is the, I'm curious on, so well, you mentioned one there, so the peacock emergible, definitely, I'm sure that's on your website. Give us a couple more flies that are pretty popular that you're tying that are maybe, you know, I don't know if they're variations of something, but so we can add to this this little list here to give people a feel for what you tie.
Okay, another one I could think of right off the top of my head is a parachute spinner pattern, and it's a pretty simple concept. I honestly, it's one of those ones where I look at and think why no one else thought of it before. And it simply, I'm basically tying a parachute pattern, hackling it a little more than I normally would, and then trimming a V in the front and rear of the, of that, you know, horizontal sitting hackle. Mm-hmm. And it essentially makes a wing profile, or more of a spent wing profile. Yeah. So after fishing here in the East, you know, again, we'll go back to the sulfur hatch, or even the Hendrickson hatch can be a little late at times, in the evening. Sulfurs in particular, they have this annoying habit of not really, the spinners a lot of times don't fall until it's totally dark. The warmer it gets to, the later it happens. So a lot of our fishing takes place in, a lot of our best fishing takes place in some super low light conditions. And, you know, most spinner patterns are designed to, you know, sit pretty flush to the water and, you know, keep a low profile, which means you can't see them at all. Which, you know, you throw it out there, especially the effective ones. Just trying to add a parachute post, you know, something you could keep an eye on better. The other thing with picky fish too, is they of course demand a good drift. On spinners in particular, they will get a very narrow lane. A lot of times there's, you know, a huge amount of bugs on the water. Fish will get on one particular seam and eat every bug that floats down that seam. But if you're an inch off of that seam, they don't even see it. It's you know, the fly really doesn't even exist for them. So not only do you need to present a good fly, you need to present it where the fish is eating them. So that, that ability to see where the fish is exactly and get your fly on his individual piece of current is key. So if you can't really tell where your fly is, you're going to be a lot less successful than when you can really sort of target that exact lane. So visibility in spinners has always been a bit of a hurdle. And I feel that that fly has come a long way to at least make that better. You know, in any time you're adding something to the top of the fly in spinners, I think it does make it slightly less effective. So there's a downside to everything. You know, we're, you know, these guys are working as hard to defeat us as we are working to defeat them. So I wouldn't say it works on every single super picky fish, but it works on probably 90% of them. And the fact that you can actually, you know, see where your fly is fishing, I think plays a big role in that too. But yeah, so the parachute spinner pattern, definitely one that probably should be being used by more people.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I just clicked over to your site and I'm looking at a bunch of cool flies. I think there's a couple you mentioned. Yeah, I mean, how many flies do you have? It seems like that's always an interesting thing because there's. It looks like you just got a ton of flies. How many do you have any idea how many flies are on your website for dry flies?
You know, I don't. And honestly, it's hugely outdated. I could probably put at least a couple dozen more on, and that's actually been a bit of a goal for this year. But I'm getting a bit swamped again on actual work. So yeah, it's always, as any small business, you know, there's like, you know, the list every day is 17 things. And if you get through four of them, you're doing pretty good.
That's right. How do you do that? How do you get through when your list piles up? Because we all struggle with that. You got 100 things on it and you probably only have enough time to get 10 things done in the week. How do you deal with that? How do you prioritize?
You know, yeah, as I mentioned before, it's I do have a procrastination streak. There's no doubt about it. You know, I'm full of distractions. Our fishing, you know, is here is almost year round. So if I really wanted to have an excuse to get out every day, I probably could. So usually, you know, and this is strictly based on my personality. It's usually deadline distress. You know, yeah, that's probably what drives most stuff. That's, you know, all right, I really need to get this done now. You know, and I do try to work on everything as hard as I can every day, but I will admit to failing on that and you know, many days. So, and you know, on top of it too, I mean, I own a home, you know, so there's, you know, a million distractions, as far as that goes, from, you know, making dinner to cutting the grass. You
That's
know?
Right.
So
yeah. All the normal stuff.
Yeah. Any small business person could certainly, you know, see that.
Yeah, totally. So Well, I'm curious. Let's take a, you know, just think about those flies. You mentioned a couple and some tips. I'm curious on tying. If we take it to like tying tips, if you think about maybe the peacock emerger, are there any techniques or tips on tying that fly that people could utilize for either that fly or other flies that you'd recommend? Maybe one tip you could shed some light on. I'm not looking at the fly right now, so I'd have to, I'm not quite sure exactly what it looks like, but we could all take a look.
Yeah, that fly, I would say the thing that people struggle with the most is the deer hair wing. It has this wing setting style, or this style, I believe, comes from Rene Harrop's hair wing fly. I think, what do you call it? A hair wing dun, I think was Rene Harrop's original pattern. And that's where I stole that wing style from. But I think people have the most problem with that, is setting that wing properly. It takes place right behind the eye, and the butts of the wing kind of create the head of the fly. So it's a little similar to an elk hair caddis in that sense. And the way that I have done it over the years, and there's just kind of two ways. Either you can tie the wing in with the butts still attached and then clip them off afterwards, or you can clip the butts off first and then catch that kind of short end of the butts with the thread and lock it down. I find the latter version to be much better, especially on smaller flies, trimming the butts off first. But it is a technique that's a little hard to master at first. But I think in general, it makes the whole rest of, you know, finishing off the fly in that easier. And also makes for a more secure wing and kind of a better finish to the fly. Okay, so if I were to leave the butts on the hair, this would be a hollow comparadon type deer hair. Mm-hmm. I would lash that down, and most of my thread wraps are going to kind of end up in the same place. I can pull it back and I can wrap in between a little bit, but it tends to make a kind of a bulkier head once I trim it off. So I don't end up usually with quite as secure of a head. If I trim the butts off first, I'll take two loose wraps around it, and I'm trying to catch maybe about a millimeter or so. Yep. And obviously that's going to vary a little bit for size of the fly. Mm-hmm. But I'll try to catch maybe a millimeter or so of the end of the butts and cinch down on that, get it to flare and lock down to the hook. And then I'll actually wrap the thread into those butts a bit and kind of trap it down in more places, kind of staying in between it a bit. And it just gives her a very secure wing. Your wing won't rock back and forth much. A lot of people, if you in just, you know, you shouldn't go mangling flies in the shop. But I guarantee if you pick up a lot of commercially available elk hair caddis right now, yeah, you can swing the wing right over to the side without any trouble at all.
That's right.
So those little types of things, I think, are just points that.
Yep.
Take you to the next level, I guess, of fly tying. And it's always nothing brings the fly tying class to a screeching halt like setting deer hair wings. Maybe the whip finisher is the only when it comes to beginner classes.
Yeah, deer hair is tough.
Yeah, those two things do seem to kind of torment people a bit. Getting a handle on that and getting comfortable with handling the hair, and, you know, especially in the smaller ones, the amount of hair, all of that are definitely hurdles, probably the biggest hurdles to that fly.
Yeah, that is big. No, that's good. And what about, before we jump into a few more flies here, I'm just curious on the spinner you mentioned, the parachute spinner. Is there a tip or a technique or something on tying that one you might highlight here?
Parachutes in general are really, I've probably seen a million ways to tie parachutes, and I've fiddled with a bunch myself. Years ago, I had a order of several thousand parachute flies to get through, and it really forced me to sit down and try to just, it's funny. I learned this from AK Best in AK Best's book in particular, Production Tying. He really, talks about trying to, you know, it's almost a distillation process. And the best analogy I can come up with is sort of Hemingway's writing style. Write a sentence and then find out whatever words you can take out of that sentence that aren't necessary to get it down to its very essence and as short as possible. And I think that is the key to, you know, commercial fly tying in general and mass producing patterns, is having everything that needs to be there and nothing that doesn't need to be there. And that comes to the technique of tying as well as the parts and everything else. So, so I sat down and really fiddled with parachutes for a long time. And, I did it on Facebook. I'm not really on Facebook anymore, but, I did do a tying tutorial on my parachute technique somewhere.
Oh, nice.
I might even be on Instagram.
Oh yeah.
But what I do is I almost all of my parachutes are tied with poly yarn for the wing. And I'll use, different poly yarns. I've been using a little bit different materials recently, some more shinier stuff and that. But in general, some sort of synthetic poly yarn.
Yeah.
So what I do, I start with the tail, tie in the tail. Typically on a tail, I will bend back the butts of the tail down along the body, cut them off at a taper, and use the thread to kind of build a taper. For the abdomen of the fly.
Yep.
So I would have the fattest part in the center tapering down towards the tail for the back half of the fly. So then on the front part there where I'm going to put the wing, what I would do is take a piece of poly yarn, half of what I want the whole wing to be, and I'm going to bend that underneath the hook and pull it up till it's vertical on top of the hook. And then I basically bring my thread over it and lash it down. So it's essentially bent underneath the hook and pulled straight up and then tied down. So what that does is it creates a taper from the wing post down to the eye. So I've got the thorax part is the fattest part. I've got a taper from the butt or from the tail up to the center and from the center down to the eye. So that just kind of builds a nice platform there. And then what I usually do at that point, if it's a dubbed fly, I would dub the body all together, and then I tie in the hackle vertically on the post. So my hackle would be tied in by the butt, sticking straight up, parallel with the post. Bring my thread back to the eye, kind of around the dubbing. And I can even, if it's a bigger pattern where you've got to make a couple turns, I'll put a little more dubbing on the thread just to hide the thread. Bring the dubbing back to the eye, wrap the hackle and tie the hackle off, behind the eye. If you try that or actually tie them that way, they're extremely durable. The fly will pretty much never come apart unless you break the hackle stem. It's just an efficient way to do them. Just an easy way to kind of complete parachutes. The other point with the poly yarn too, is I'm able to leave it a little longer because it's cheap poly yarn, and I can hold on to it well, wrap my hackle around it easily, and then when I'm done whip finishing it off, I might mash the hackle a little bit. I can hold that post and kind of preen my hackle back into shape where it's supposed to be, and then clip the post off where I want it.
Yep, there you go.
So it just makes for a fairly easy way to do them. If you're doing calf tail or, calf body hair ones, you're stuck with the old style.
Yeah.
I still like that, tying one or tying the back into the center, the tail into the center and the post down to the eye. But you're forced to, stack it first and deal with that short length and everything.
Yeah,
so for my own flies, I avoid it altogether.
Yeah. It seems like the calf tail is not the best, easiest material to work
with. Oh, it's brutal.
Do you still tie? Yeah. Do you tie any with the calf tail?
For myself, no. I did just tie a bunch of wolves for a customer, and I had to use a bunch of calf tail. And in the bigger, these were for Atlantic salmon, so it wasn't too bad. But yeah, it is definitely one of my least favorite materials to work with. It just takes it takes longer to do than anything else. You have to kind of hand stack it a little bit. It doesn't because of the kind of kinkly nature of it. It doesn't stack well. It kind of fights you in the stacker. So definitely a time-consuming material.
Yeah, nice. Well, let's keep going. Let's try to get a few more of these flies. I'm just curious to give us a perspective on some of the stuff you're tying regularly. What are some other top dry flies that you've that you get requests for or something on your site?
I'm trying to think here. I probably should have looked at that again.
I could take a look, and I'm looking at a couple of these. Might be older ones, but I'm looking at there's a few here. One of them, and maybe this is similar, but like the disabled Dunn Hendrickson, is that similar to? Yeah,
no, that's a good one to bring up. That is a bit of a unique style of tie there too. That fly again, basically for fussy trout, and trying to just have another option, as I've often said about, especially sulfurs. In the Northeast here, you literally cannot have enough patterns. Even what killed them yesterday might be completely useless the next day. So having more ammo, more things to try on a day-to-day basis really comes in. So that's where that fly has come in. And it's another one that's designed to kind of imitate that emergent stage, or where they're kind of stuck for a minute, or a fly that's and typically we've been calling them cripples in an effort to be a little more PC because that name hadn't been taken yet as well. I went with the disabled done, but it is an effort to imitate that bug that probably isn't going to make it one way or another. Either it's going to get eaten because it can't get away, or it's going to end up jammed under a log jam somewheres. That's what it's really designed to imitate. And the interesting technique, or the main technique on that fly, is putting snowshoe rabbit into a dubbing loop. And I've managed to tie these down to 18s even, and it gets a little tricky. What I do to start with, I guess we got to go back to the material, is I'm taking snowshoe rabbit feet, and usually using the hair along the heel section of it. If you're very familiar with these feet, they tend to have longer, a little kinkier hair up near the toe section of the foot, and the heel part of the foot tends to have shorter, a little more uniform hair. So typically I'll take and use an X-Acto blade and kind of cut that hair off as close as I can down. I'll put it in the little coffee grinder and buzz it up a little bit till I have a nice mix of the very soft under fur and the very stiff guard hairs of it, and trying to keep it relatively short. So you would basically tie the back half of the fly is tied similarly to a nymph. In fact, on most of them, I use a wire rib, which is an effort to get that body to sit very low, in the back and to kind of hang down. I do them on, the hook I typically use is a Daiichi 1260, which is a longer kind of gradually curved, hook. So I want to get that bottom part to sit down. The tail is usually wood duck, or on the bigger ones, I use ostrich to imitate a green drake shuck. So what I'm trying to imitate here is either the tails of the fly, the tails of the nymph, or kind of a shuck part on the back as it's breaking open. More of a nymph color on the back, and then the thorax of the fly would match the dun section. So the back half's kind of tied almost like a hare's ear nymph. I'm pretty much using hare's ear type dubbing, a little bit different in color scheme, but along those lines, ribbing it, and then tying in a deer hair wing like you would tie in a comparadon. So the deer hair wing is kind of centered in the thorax part. And then I do make a little short, maybe 2-inch long dubbing loop, and this is done with the same 8-0 tying thread that I'm using, so you got to be somewhat delicate with it. I've tried using heavier thread, and I don't like the performance as much, so I've just learned to kind of be delicate with the 8-0, but doing dubbing loops and 8-0 thread is a little bit of a challenge. You have to have a bit of a finesse. I'd load up about 1.5 inches or so of hair in that loop, and I'm trying to keep the hair very thin. Essentially, what I'm trying to make is a hair hackle. Once I spin that up, I'm going to have it. And actually, what I'll do is put the hair in the loop and then trim it off. So I'm keeping it pretty flat in the loop, and then I'll trim off the tips of it and try to get it about the length I want before I spin it up. Then when I spin it, I'm essentially making kind of a hair hackle. I'm going to wrap that up from the back, kind of go past the wing and tie it off in the front. And it does that great job of floating the fly, very good job of trapping air bubbles and stuff when you false cast. And it's kind of a proven shape. We're basically talking comparadon or sparkle dun shape. So that's a very proven, very effective shape. And then just adding a little bit of kind of diffusion to the area where stuff's going on. And the thoughts that it looks like just kind of a messy emergence, or a
thorax,
a busted shock, as they're trying to climb out. So
that's right. Well, what is the, on the comparadon wing, does it matter if it's, kind of going backwards a little bit or straight up versus forward? Because you kind of see a little bit on, looks like this one's going back a little bit.
Yep. On those flies, the wing is tied with the butts forward on that fly. That's a good point to notice, Dave. It is tied more like that hair wing style, Comparadons are, in my opinion, always tied with the butts in the back. I tried to fight that for a while years ago. I have no idea. It seems backwards to fly. The way the wing looks on the fly seems mm-hmm. backwards. I mean, no mayfly has a wing that slants over its head. No. Every mayfly wing slants towards the abdomen. I have no idea why that fly works as well as it does. It's one of the sparkle dun, in my opinion, is if you could only ever have one dry fly, I would probably choose the sparkle dun. Even oh, it's, really? You know, it's Craig Matthews fly. It started with the Swisher Richards, comparadon. Yeah. And then I think, Matthews added the trailing shuck and changed the, his version to the sparkle dun. In my opinion, it is one of the most effective flies ever invented. Wow. On top of it, it's a cheap and simple fly to tie once you get a relationship with the deer hair wing. It's a cheap fly.
That's
but
awesome.
it's an amazingly effective fly. If people listening to this are not using it on pressured fish, do yourself a favor and try some, especially the shuck version, the sparkle dun, an amazingly effective dry fly.
There you go. Well, that's a good point. Yeah, the sparkle dun works all around. I mean, it seems like everywhere. So you mentioned that as a good one, a good fly that you just like. I'm not sure how many of those you tie. What are some other flies? It sounds like you do quite a bit of fishing as far when you're tying or fishing the dry flies out there. What other flies do you like to fish?
Well, the ones we've talked about, I probably fish the most, mm-hmm. You know, my own fishing for picky fish. A couple other flies that I probably use in Western New York here, we have some of these creeks that are, you know, spring creeks to limestoney kind of streams, which are pretty difficult, you know, from a selective fish standpoint. Mm-hmm. And then we have a lot of small wild streams that are super spooky. The fish are like very hard to approach at times. They're very, very small water, very spooky fish. But on the other hand, pretty much dumb as stumps as far as flies, you know, selection goes. If you can get it on the water without scaring them, they'll probably eat it. So one of my favorite all-time flies for fishing that water is about a size 12 yellow-bodied stimulator.
Oh, stimulator, yep.
Yeah, we have a lot of kind of yellow stone flies around here, a lot of mm-hmm. kind of small stone flies, a lot of lighter colored caddis, all that stuff. And there's not a specific bug that we see all the time that this fly imitates, but for some reason, a yellow bodied sulfur, pretty light colored in general, usually like a ginger hackle on the body and a grizzly hackle on the thorax. Mm-hmm. Is just extremely productive fly for those streams. Yeah. So stimulator's always been one of my favorites. Kind of a classic love-hate relationship tying them.
One last quick break for our final sponsor today. They're back, baby. They're back. Fly Fishing Film Tour is back. Don't miss this year's 2022 F3T as it returns to theaters near you. Another amazing season. This is really some cool stuff that I remember back to my first session at F3T. And not only do you get a lot of the guests that you've heard on this podcast to see some of their videos, like Captain Jack Productions. I'm not sure if Nick has anything going this year, but it's just some of the best basically film out there as far as fly fishing. And it's kind of like that Warren Miller style of coolness and diversity. So yeah, this is awesome. It's a good place to take your friends or family or yourself. Head out there and you can go to a special event, grab a beer, sit back, relax. Given that there's no COVID outbreak, obviously. But kidding aside, get out there and do it. Let's put this behind us and let's jump into F3T full on and support them. Please head over to wetflyswing.com/F3T to show your support for this podcast and get your inspiration for your next big trip right now. That's it. Let's do this. Wetflyswing.com/F3T or you can just head over to flyfilmtour.com. Booyah! Okay, back to the show. give us a tip on that. Is that all about having the right hackle, or how do you tie a good stimulator? Because sometimes you see those that are nice and thin and sometimes even flattened and stuff like that. But how do you make one that isn't just bulky and nasty looking?
Well, the main, it's funny. Sometimes these flies are invented, and then I blame Umpqua personally. Let's just go right there. But a lot of times these flies get, they get commercialized, and they tend to lose the points that they originally succeeded with. A glaring example I can think of right off the bat is the fly that everyone knows as the Thorax, which I believe is credited to Mike Lawson from Henry's Fork Anglers there originally, bears almost zero resemblance to Vince Marinaro's original Thorax pattern, which was designed specifically to look like the way a mayfly sit on the water. And these flies are almost unrecognizable one to the other. Yet they have the same name. And I think when that happened, it was, of course, you know, not that Lawson's pattern is a bad pattern. It's just that it has kind of been refined down so much that it really doesn't even bear any resemblance to the original. And I think at the expense of some of the good points of the original, which were mainly the exact way it sat on the water more than the actual look of the fly. Marinaro was very concerned with the impression flies made a lot more than the actual pattern of the fly. So trying to sort of look at it from the fish's viewpoint a little bit. So I think at times we can sort of maybe outwit ourselves a little bit, simplifying things. So we definitely have to be cognizant of that to not – in the distillation process to not remove the key elements, in any pattern really. So, as far as, concerns the actual, you know, the stimulator itself and tying it, the point of that is that rear hackle should be, at most about the gap of the hook. And that's kind of a key element to getting that fly to sit properly. You don't want a long hackle on the back. And it was the reason originally it was tied with two hackles. So that the front hackle should be kind of normal dry fly hackle. And that really affects the way the fly sits. So that's one key. And then the other one, I think, is getting the proportion right of thorax to body. And it should be a little closer to half than a third. I think most people think it's about a third. If you try to tie them at about a third, you'll find that your front gets short in a hurry. I think if you start off, thinking it about halfway, you'll probably creep towards 5/8, which is probably about where it should be. So.
Yep, and then there's plenty of is it deer hair or elk hair on that thing?
Probably depends. I think the original was elk. But I'll use whatever myself, more on color than anything.
Yeah, more color. Yep. Nice. Okay, so this is good. So we got a little list here. I'm curious if we're taking it, say, March. What's it look like? Tell us in March. Are you fishing much trout wise in March in Western New York?
Myself, not really. Probably a little bit. If I did go anywhere, it would be to a spring creek here that gets a pretty good midge hatch. Mm-hmm. That would be about it. I personally don't take a lot of pleasure in nymphing for trout anymore. It's just not something I really enjoy. And, you know, before the politics even gets a chance to enter into this, I base my fishing on what I like to do, what I personally enjoy to do when I'm on the stream. I think every angler should do that exact same thing.
Yeah.
Don't listen to your friends. Don't listen to whatever else, you know, nymphing's bad. Oh, you know, dry flies are snobs, whatever. I mean, fish, you know, that's the whole idea of going fishing is to enjoy yourself. Go out and enjoy yourself. Fish the way you like to fish. I personally like to dry fly fish. I like to see trout come up to my fly. If I have to nymph, I do enjoy some sight fishing nymphing. A lot of these spring creeks, you can see the fish relatively well, and fishing small midge pupas to them and trying to see when the fish actually eat your fly to me is kind of a fascinating way to nymph. And about the only way I really enjoy it. I just don't really enjoy nymphing very much. So most of our kind of spring fishing, I would be steelhead fishing or still tying.
So you're still tying, yeah. And yeah. That's a good note on the Paul. We had a recent listener ask me, or we were talking about episodes, new episodes, and he said do one on the New York area. I think he was thinking about the Salmon River of all the, explain the different types of steelhead, you know, like you got people flossing out there. I guess you got all sorts of different things. And he said,
sure.
He says it's a big challenge for people new because he said there's this one guy who went out on a guide trip. He was brand new to steelheading, went with a guide who basically taught him how to floss.
Sure.
And then he got out there and he was just flossing all the time. And then he didn't even know that some people look down at that. You know what I mean? So I think just clarifying for especially people new to it, like what is accept? Well, I don't even know acceptable, but I think you say it the best. Like whatever you're having a good time doing, just do that, right? As long as it's legal, what's wrong with doing that sort of thing?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I guess I should, these days I probably should put a, legality or ethics, clause on that. definitely the big no-nos in whether it's steelhead or anything else, around here is fishing to fish that are actively spawning.
Oh, yeah.
That's definitely, yeah. Bottom of the bucket type stuff there.
Yeah.
Now in the spring, in the Great Lakes or out west, there's definitely seasons that coincide with spawning fish. If you're swinging a fly down a run and you happen to hook a hen that's bearing eggs or even is dumping eggs occasionally happens, I don't consider that to be the angler's fault. You know, if you're targeting, you know, gravelly, shallow areas where you can see fish spawning and you're, you know, kind of working that stuff, that's, you know, definitely getting off the ethics bandwagon a little bit there. Yeah. But, you know, at times we catch, you know, dropback fish, we catch spawning fish just kind of swinging down a run. You know, they're sitting there, they, you know, somebody spooked them off a red, they move into the run to kind of rest or hide a little bit, whatever. So that type of stuff happens. I don't think that's bad. It's kind of inadvertent, you know. But on the other hand, if I go out in the spring, I'll see a lot of guys walking around in their riffles with, you know, 3 feet of fly line hanging out of the rod tip. And they're basically like looking for fish to cast to. Now those are fish that are, you know, actively up on the gravel spawning.
Yeah.
You know, that's bad. Definitely. Yeah. It's just not a good thing to do. It's not an ethical thing to do.
No, definitely not.
As far as that goes. But yeah, that's probably the biggest no-no. Obviously, you know, outright snagging fish. Honestly, Dave, a couple weeks ago, I was fishing a stream here, and I snagged one with a swung fly. Water was kind of low. I was using an unweighted rig. I had a size 10 bugger with a cone on it. So a very small fly, very little weight. And I ended up hooking one basically in the adipose fin.
Oh, a steelhead?
Yeah. So I'm sure I just kind of swung it across its back and ended up, you know, it found a spot to grab. And it honestly, it felt just like a take too. The fly was just starting to straighten out at the end and felt a little thump and fish on. And, you know, and then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, this feels weird. And then he's, you know, flailing all over the place. So
there you go. Yeah. Tough to land.
But, you know, so stuff happens, you know, but, you know, if you're out there, you know, again, walking around with a couple feet of fly line out looking for fish, yeah, you're being unethical. So I guess just a little touch on that.
That's a good reminder. And you mentioned steelhead. Just for a quick second, I'm curious on steelhead flies. What's your, you know, I know you tie a lot of steelhead flies out there. What's your number one most, like right now, what are you tying most of for steelhead flies?
Probably the pattern I've tied the most the last couple of years is a pattern called a Bill's Spey, which is it's a spey fly, but it's do you want to go into this?
if we have to do a whole episode, maybe we could wait on it, but if you could maybe do it in a few minutes, then yeah.
Okay. I'll try to kind of, brush through it here relatively quickly. This fly is, it's a kind of a modern spey fly, I guess we'll call it. And it's achieving a spey look, but it's not using a spey hackle. What I'm actually using for the hackle on it is, bleach burned pheasant tail and sometimes turkey tail. So these are fibers that have been put in bleach enough to burn the little rachias off them that make them grip together like Velcro. So these are now fibers that are loose and won't cling together. Essentially what you do is you tie in a section of dubbing, and then you tie in a clump of pheasant tail by the butts, work it around the hook as much as you want, lash them down good, tie another section of dubbing. Tie another section of pheasant tail. So when you're done, it looks like a hackle is pommered up the body. Hmm. Well, this allows me to create effective, durable spey flies, but not using the kind of regular materials for them, which typically we're using a material that is a goose shoulder feather, which has also been burned in bleach to achieve that same kind of heron-like, you know, texture to it, and where the fibers won't stick together. But they're kind of a poor substitute. In this country, blue heron, great blue heron, is still illegal to use. There is some use of gray heron, which is from Europe, which is harvested at times. So there is some of that around. Gray heron, honestly, is kind of a poor substitute too. Tends to be very long fibers. Great blue heron, there's an obvious reason that that was spey hackle. It's by far the most impressive spey hackle. We have blue-eared pheasant too, which does a decent job, but is tends to be kind of short-stemmed, so very hard to palmer over much of a body. If you're lucky, you can get two or three turns on a palmer with blue-eared pheasant. So this fly was designed basically to be able to tie spey flies without having to sort of kill ourselves to come up with hackle. And
there you go.
It's typically has either a bronze mallard or recently I use a feather wing version of it for the most part. And just a very buggy fly, good low water fly. And I guess unique enough that it's probably the last couple of years, I've probably tied more of those than any other steelhead fly.
Yeah, it's a good looking fly. I'm looking at it now, and you have what's the feather wing on top?
Usually either a dyed grizzly or a Cree. Hackle, depending on what I can get. I tend to go through a lot of it. And honestly, if there's any bird raiser guys out there, get us more hackle with round tips. Everybody's, you know, they've all gone to, you know, finer and longer and finer and longer. And that's great for dry flies, but not so great for wet fly wings. We need some more. There's a few around, one in New York here, Collins Hackle. I was just looking around because I'm getting low, and seems like he's got a few more of those kind of old school birds. But yeah, we could use a little more round tipped wet fly hackle.
Nice. No, I was gonna say, yeah, that fly looks cool, and it's got a big, big, nice.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, nice juicy round old school wing on it, and all these steelhead flies are awesome. So I'll put links out to this. Well, let's wrap this up with the Ask a Pro segment here. And I had a tip or a question from Greg Jacobson, and his question. I guess you kind of noted this a little bit starting out, but tip on tying small dry flies. So go back to the dry fly. So I'm not sure how small flies you tie. But that's a challenge, right? Depending on the fly, tying a 18 or 20 or even smaller. What would be one tip you say if somebody's struggling with tying small dry flies?
I'd say right off the bat with tying small flies is proper magnification or proper visibility. I'm 52 at this point, so glasses are key to everything. I don't know how old you are, Dave, but it's
right behind you.
You got about a mid 40s cliff there. You're going to fall off into can't see anything up close. Number one, being able to see what you're doing. If you can't see the details, you're going to be terrible at this. And whether you need to wear the full, journey to the center of the earth glasses, or you can get away with reading glasses, whatever. But you're definitely going to need something to be able to see well. Second thing would be proper thread. Typically, your 8-0 uni is going to be kind of bulky for this stuff. It depends on the fly. If you need that strength, I'll give a little plug here to Vivus. Get yourself some Vivus 16-0, unbelievably good thread in the smaller diameters in particular. Good thread. And then, just trying to, if you're a beginner tire, probably use half of what you started with as far as the material. Like if you're cutting off a section of dubbing to put in or whatever, you're starting with some dubbing, you probably have twice what you need. So try to keep everything as thin as possible. And this, I'm going to throw this tip out unsolicited in all aspects of dry fly tying. Do yourself a favor and get some good photos of the actual bug you're trying to make a fly pattern of. I cannot stress that enough. My dry fly tying in particular is on or was on a, you know, an exact curve with my ability to shoot macro on SLR cameras. It's an unbelievable parallel. You will learn 100 times more looking at a good photo. Look at, I've got a bunch of photos around of flies. Ted Fossaglia comes to mind right off for the Northeast. Look at photos of the bugs you're trying to imitate. You'll be shocked. Everybody thinks the mayfly has a rib that's darker than the abdomen. If you look at any mayfly, there's literally one mayfly where the segment line is darker than the body. Almost every mayfly, the segment line is lighter colored than the actual body segment. Show me a dry fly that's tied that way. There's something we're trying to imitate. Be as familiar as you possibly can be with what you're trying to imitate.
Yeah, that's a great tip. And on the a little bonus tip here, I'm curious on the steelhead. We could either talk about the bills or the fly or any like steelhead in general. Looks like you tied it on a tube fly. Do you tie? Maybe start there. Do you tie a lot of tubes? Then also give us a steelhead tying tip.
I do tie a fair amount of tubes. I think some patterns just kind of look a little better on a tube. Some look a little better on shanks. I think if I'm thinking back on the last couple of years, I'm probably 50-50 for customers. A lot more shanks. I started making my own shanks a few years ago, mainly because I thought the commercial ones were terrible and massively overpriced. I started doing it myself. So at this point, I probably do a few more shanks than I do tubes, but it's fairly close. Let's see, on tying tips for steelhead.
And on your, as you think about that, I'm just looking on. So how do you, when you make your own custom shanks, this is just literally kind of, describe that, how you do that.
Well, I'm starting off with stainless wire. And then essentially bending it, you have to kind of work through the formula of how long you want each part of the bend. You essentially have three parts, the main part and two return wires that are bent back, you know, one from the back and one from the front. So kind of figuring out how you want that to all lay out. After tying on them over the years, I determined that I prefer to have that sort of nice flat platform or nice rounded platform down the fly. So the way I designed mine is the return wire from the eye goes all the way back to the back of the fly or the back of the shank in order to have a smooth transition there so we don't have a big drop off somewhere. And then the return wire that starts from is bent from the rear of the shank comes up underneath the shank and ends at about a point where you would sort of end the body on your fly and begin adding hackles and whatever from there. And setting the wing. So it mostly an attempt to kind of smooth off what was the lumpy parts of other commercially available shanks there. So essentially I'm taking a length of wire, bending it, forming an eye on one end, and then bending it, forming an eye on the other end. And typically either bending that up or down or even straight, depending on the type of shanks. And I do kind of standard steelhead shanks and then shanks for streamers that have a little bit bigger eyes. Of course, the articulated streamers are so popular these days. So shanks that work in conjunction with a hook or using multiple shanks together, having a little bit bigger eye tends to make them not hang up as much.
There you go. And I was just thinking on the tip, you mentioned the burning the hackle to imitate. So there's that, but also the... So if you're putting that hackle wing on top, how do you get that? Well, give us a tip there. How do you get that to stand up straight and not bend on you and be durable?
Yeah. Well, the main thing is too, using the right size feathers. You're using mostly the larger feathers on a cape. Pretty much all, well, I shouldn't say that. I guess I do use some saddle too, but you're typically using feathers that have pretty good stems. And that shouldn't be anything to kind of, shy away from. You want fairly good, robust stems. The main, in any steelhead wing or, salmon fly wing type of thing, most of the trick to it is in the pre-tying. It's before you even tie it. It's the kind of manipulation of that feather to where it's easy to tie in. So by the time I tie them in, they pretty much just sit right where they're supposed to. So what I would do is I take two feathers that I think are matched. I put them together the way that they're going to sit. So that's going to be inside to inside. So the outside of each feather is on the outside. Pinch them together, check them for length. I clip off the stem. And then what I do is kind of pull right at where I clipped it off. There's going to be, you know, fibers there. And I'll pull usually three or four of those fibers out perpendicular to the shank. And then I trim those off with the scissors. And this is another, it's something I do with dry fly hackle too. If you pull those fibers off, you now created a very slippery stem that can pull out from under thread very easily. But if you cut those fibers off, you created either three or four little bumps there that are actually going to grab your thread and make it almost impossible to pull that wing out from underneath. So that's a good trick right there, is not pulling those fibers off, but trimming them off. And then from there, I hold the wing in the position it's going to go on to fly. And on these types of flies, they're, it's the old Sid Glasso technique of they're sort of tented. So they're kind of pitched in towards the center of the fly a little bit. So each wing, the center or the top of the feather is going to be over the center of the fly, and the bottom of the feather is going to be over the side of the fly. The way they sit. So they are kind of leaning in towards the center a bit. So what I would do is hold that feather in the position I wanted to, and then I'm grabbing that cut off piece of stem with a pair of flat jawed pliers. And that plier is going to mash the stem flat. And then from there, so I'm holding the pliers in my right hand. I have the feather in my left hand, put it in the pliers, mash it flat. And then I'm going to twist that stem a little bit to get it in the right sitting position. So some of them, most of the time, if you're using a neck hackle, it'll squash almost in that position just because of the shape of the stem to begin with. But some of them need a little bit of manipulation, so you got to kind of twist them a little bit. And then the final step is to take the whole feather and push it towards the pliers while the butt is pinched in the pliers. And that puts a little bit of a crook in it, and that allows it to kind of go up and then back. So you've actually put a little bit of a bump in there, and that just makes your wings sit a little bit better. So
nice. That's a killer. Yeah. Thanks for walking us through that. That's an awesome, awesome tip for sure.
No problem. I hope it made sense.
Yeah, no, it did. It did. Good. So, good. Well, I guess we put together a show here, Nick. We've got, you know, definitely some good tips here. Anything else you want to leave before we head out of here? It feels like, you know, you've got people, if they want to connect with you, just head to your website, or where should we send them if they want to connect with you and get some flies?
Oh yeah. Yeah. The website's great. Emailing me is fine. I look at my email every day. For the record, I'm not on Facebook at all anymore. So don't even bother sending anything there. I do look at Instagram just about every day too. So I'm usually pretty reactive on there, and I say definitely check my email every day. So,
okay, perfect. Yeah, we'll send everybody out to nickpianessa.com or what's your Instagram feed again?
Is Magog Smelt.
Yeah, Magog. That's how do you spell that for us?
It's Magog Smelt, old main fly pattern.
There you go. Awesome. Good stuff, Nick. Well, I'll let you get out of here, and we'll send everybody your way. And thanks again for shedding some light on what you have going. We definitely have been getting some requests from the northeast part of the country, and you know, I know that's a hot spot for steelhead and trout. So it's good. There's always another episode, so hopefully we'll connect with you down the line. And thanks again.
You're welcome, Dave. Thank you.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes, all links, and everything else we covered today, head over to wetflyswing.com/288. 288. We are approaching 312 episodes. If we keep this pace, I am guessing we're going to get there in about a month. 300 episodes. Do the numbers. That is a very good sized number. You can support this podcast at wetflyswing.com/subscribe. Subscribe. You can get notified. And I mentioned that earlier about subscribing to the podcast app. And obviously that's a pretty easy way to do it because a lot of people listen on the app. But if you go to wetflyswing.com and just click in the sidebar anywhere on there and subscribe to what we have there at the website,
you'll get some bonus content, some bonus updates. There's some stuff there that we do when we have new things coming out, new trips, new products. Maybe we have a new product coming out this year. New hat, new partner. If you want to check out some of the cool brands we support, obviously, we've had some cool sponsors that I've noted here today. And you can go there as well. But yeah, I just want to give a shout out to that because the newsletter is a pretty big thing that we have going. And it's always a way to kind of dig deeper and get it all in one value-packed, power-packed deal. So there's always a bonus or two there. Thanks again. I appreciate you today for sticking with us. You know, I'm not even sure where are we headed next. Where are we headed next? I don't have it in front of me right now, but it's always a good one, and we try to get a little bit in. If you have a question or a comment for the show, head over to Wetfly Swing, or just send me an email right now, Dave at Wetfly Swing. I always love to see those emails. Those are the special things. If I get those, you know, daily, it always makes my day. And follow us on social. One last blast, and let me know what I can do for you. Thanks again. I am looking forward to connecting with you right now online, right now, or on the river, hopefully on a trip.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.